From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. After a tough struggle, the intelligence reform bill has passed the House. The administration managed to bring to heel dissenting Republican House members with some minor changes in the bill's wording. So after days of discussion behind closed doors, the bill was approved moments ago, 336-75. Both Congress and the Bush White House have been under heavy pressure to act on the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission. At times, that pressure came directly from the families of the victims of September 11th, who have been pounding on doors in Washington and standing vigil outside 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue to help push the bill through. So what does it contain, and will it help prevent another attack like the one on September 11th? Tonight on Point, a new intelligence bill and what that means to the safety of America. Will passage of this intelligence bill make you feel any safer? Will it usher in significant changes, or is it primarily a political exercise? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Washington is John Diamond, Washington correspondent for USA Today. Hi, John.
Good to be with you, Gail.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. And, well, 336-75, not even close. So remind us, what was the holdup here?
Not close. I'm actually a little surprised by the 75. That seems a little high to me. But the holdup was a fairly sizable coalition of House Republicans centered around the House Armed Services Committee and its chairman, Duncan Hunter of California, who were concerned that the creation of a new intelligence czar, a so-called Director of National Intelligence, a civilian official, would somehow erode the flow of information to frontline troops. And even though the shadow of 9/11 hangs over this whole debate, right now the major national security imperative is the battle in Iraq. And the notion or the fear that somehow the intelligence those soldiers and Marines need wouldn't be getting to them in a timely fashion as a result of these changes, that was compelling to the members of the Armed Services Committee. There, of course, were also turf issues involved with that committee, having to do with how much money is controlled by that panel as opposed to the House Intelligence Committee, and same on the Senate side. But it was really an issue of at the base, it was the issue of which is the most important national security challenge, fighting and winning wars or preparing and defending against potential terrorist attacks. So there was a wording change that finally satisfied Duncan Hunter, and so a large amount of opposition melted away, and that gave you the large majority vote we just had in the House.
Yeah, it is interesting when you reflect on it. Intelligence reform sounds like one of those ideas that nobody could really find objectionable until you start getting into the fine print. So also remind us about some of the more controversial provisions of the bill itself.
Well, the main one is this creation of a Director of National Intelligence, which is an enormously powerful position the way it's designed. This person would have authority over both domestic and foreign intelligence, something we've never had before. Usually there's been a pretty high wall between those two areas so that, you know, you don't get into this sort of, there was always a fear of this kind of secret police Gestapo notion being created if you had one overall intelligence figure. So now that wall's been broken down, and the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, will have both domestic and foreign intelligence power. This person will have the power to move money around from one intelligence agency to the other, even agencies that reside in the Pentagon. Again, a tremendous power. It's really a takeaway of authority from the Secretary of Defense, and it's another reason why this bill was so long in coming, because there was a major turf fight within the Bush administration between the Defense Department and those that wanted this kind of this new setup. You also have the bill creating a National Counterterrorism Center, which would deal with terrorist threats, again, both foreign and domestic, and would report directly to this Director of National Intelligence. The new official would become the principal advisor to the president on all intelligence matters, above the level of the FBI director, the CIA director, etc. So, again, a very powerful post. It's somewhat of a demotion for the CIA. Right now, the head of the CIA is also the head of Central Intelligence. And from under this bill, the CIA will just be one more of the many intelligence, the 15 intelligence agencies that make up the so-called intelligence community, a $40 billion entity. We also have money for added border patrol and detention of illegal aliens. There are minimum standards established for states to issue driver's license. So this was aimed at the 9/11 hijackers who used bogus documents to get legitimate driver's licenses, and that helped them board airplanes to fly around the country and train for 9/11 and then finally, of course, execute that horrible attack.
John, let me ask you to hold the thought there, because
yep.
I do want to check in quickly with Carrie Lamack, who is joining us from Washington. She is vice president of Families of September 11th, and her mother, Judy LaRocque, was president and CEO of Market Perspectives. She was on American Airlines Flight 11. And Carrie, a big moment for you tonight?
It's just a very emotional moment for all the family members who've been working for over 3 years now to make changes in this country to make sure that other families don't suffer the way that we have.
And why do you feel that this bill will make a difference?
Well, we know that there were intelligence gaps that led to the murders of 3,000 people, including my mom. And not only that, we've seen intelligence failures lead to the war in Iraq with the weapons of mass destruction that aren't there. We've also talked about intelligence failures with what's going on in Iran and Colin Powell's statements a few weeks ago. So it's clear that there were problems, and we're happy that this bill is going to be able to provide this country with someone at the top who can connect the dots and make sure that no more gaps or failures lead to more people dying.
Well, this bill does incorporate many of the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission, but not all of them. Are you concerned about some of the provisions that did not make it into the final legislation?
Well, of course, the fact that congressional oversight, which was a huge issue, has not been changed is something that we're going to need to work on. But let me tell you, we get 10,000 more Border Patrol men and women at the borders stopping illegal immigrants from coming. We get new visa security standards. We get new federal standards for IDs for what can be used to board an aircraft. We get biometric entry and exit databases. This bill has so much that make this country safer. We're just so thankful that it got past the House and now it's on to the Senate and then hopefully in an eventual signing with the president.
And Carrie, do you have any concerns? I'm sure you've heard some expressed by civil liberties groups about rights being infringed upon by this bill. Not an issue for you?
Well, we were supporting the Senate bill, which had an independent civil liberties board. The civil liberties board that passed the House today is not quite as independent as we would have hoped for. But there's room to change that, and we can address that in further legislation. You know, Congress hasn't ended forever. They're just going to end for the year. They'll be back in less than a month now. So I think that there's time to address some of those issues. But let's get it straight here. The real issue is intelligence reform. You know, if we can have the right intelligence, we won't have to have terrorists coming into this country. So I really think it's an intelligence issue, and this bill addresses that.
Well, Carrie, thanks so much for taking a few moments to be with us tonight.
Thank you. And I just want to thank all of the members of Congress who supported us through this and to thank the president for his support. It really made a difference.
Thanks, Carrie.
Thank you.
Carrie Lamack is vice president of Families of September 11th. So, John Diamond of USA Today, let me go back to that thought about the civil liberties piece of it. Some organizations are very worried about these broad new surveillance and anti-immigration powers. Are their concerns being addressed in this final version, or might they be addressed more fully in the Senate version?
Well, the version, the bill will not change. The bill that the House passed will go to the Senate. There won't be opportunities for amendments. This is sort of final passage on the bill. There's no opportunity to make any further changes at this point unless they kill the bill. But one of the reasons why there were 75 votes against is that there was a fairly large coalition of Republicans based around the House Judiciary Committee and Representative Sensenbrenner, the chairman of that committee, who wanted even tougher immigration standards. Making it much tougher for an illegal alien to declare asylum, to gain asylum protections from potentially rough treatment by the regime from wherever they came from. There were provisions that established new penalties, tougher penalties, even and death penalties for various crimes related to terrorism. The Senate just wasn't ready to go that far and rejected some of these ideas. There was an idea for a single national driver's license or identification, very controversial among civil libertarians, the idea that we'd all be required to carry a uniform national ID around. It sort of goes against the grain of kind of the American experience for a lot of members of Congress. They weren't willing to go for that, so they rejected those. That made it tougher to get this bill through, and it's why there are 75 House members, most of those were Republicans, voting against. So the civil libertarians won some victories on that score, but they are concerned. The big victory that they won was the creation of the Independent Civil Liberties Board, which will have some influence to step in and blow the whistle if the government goes to excess in its pursuit of alleged terrorists. But I think the comments by the 9/11 family member and their involvement, it's been amazing to have, as a beat reporter who covers intelligence, it's a fairly sort of esoteric, off on its own area of national security. We're just not used to seeing public involvement in the intelligence debate. 9/11 changed all that, and it was extraordinary to see the families wearing buttons with pictures of their lost loved ones on their lapels, coming to Washington repeatedly for hearings, going door to door, knocking on congressmen's doors, and really pressing for this bill. It's an entirely new experience in terms of how intelligence legislation is made. Usually, it's done mostly in secret and with very little public debate.
Fair to say it wouldn't have happened without the families?
I think so. I think the involvement by the families, I think that the tremendous public interest in the 9/11 Commission report and what the commission had to say, because of the excellent and thorough job done by that commission in examining and writing really an extraordinary report on the whole 9/11 disaster. Those two things provided enormous political energy. The third ingredient, I think, was the fear by members of Congress that if they opposed this bill and there were another terrorist attack, they would be in a pretty vulnerable political position.
Sure, on record. Well, and speaking of things that have changed along the way, I recall, and I'm sure many other people do, that President Bush was initially resistant to the idea of a 9/11 commission itself, as well as some of its suggestions for intelligence reform, including the one about a national director of intelligence who had full budget authority all these 15 agencies. So why the change of mind there?
Again, I think the political influence of the 9/11 Commission was very important. I think that perhaps that plus the massive intelligence of failure surrounding Iraq, which became clear in the months after the March 2003 invasion of Iraq, coming 2 years after 9/11, that added further energy to the idea that there needed to be major change in intelligence. I should note, though, parenthetically, that there is another government commission looking into the intelligence failures revolving around weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. It's operating entirely in secret. It has had virtually no public hearings, totally unlike the approach taken by the 9/11 Commission. And I think the main reason for that is that there isn't a family group which with lost loved ones, although God knows we've had losses in Iraq, but there isn't an organized family group relating to Iraq pressing for intelligence reform. So a totally different approach this time around.
Well, we're going to continue on that point in just a moment after we take a break. John Diamond, stay with us. We're talking this hour about the intelligence reform bill, which prompted a heated fight on Capitol Hill. Well, now that the bill has passed the House, what's in it? And what will it mean, the effort to protect Americans? Does passage of this intelligence bill make you feel any safer, or do you think it's mostly a political exercise? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about intelligence reform. The House has just passed a new intelligence bill that will bring big changes to the structure of the intelligence community. But will it help prevent another attack on the United States? And why did it take 3 years for Congress to deal directly with intelligence failures? Does this seem an adequate response to the 9/11 Commission report? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been speaking with John Diamond, Washington correspondent for USA Today. Also joining me now from Washington is Jennifer Sims, visiting professor of intelligence at Georgetown's Securities Studies Program. She served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Intelligence Coordination and is co-editor of the new book, Transforming Intelligence. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you, Gail. I'm glad to be here.
And also, David Kay is with us now. He is Chief U.S. Arms Inspector in Iraq. He was appointed by the Director of Central Intelligence to lead the search for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and to direct the Iraq Survey Group. He's now a senior fellow at the Potomac Institute. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to be with you, Gail.
David, let me start with you. What do you think would have happened if this bill had not passed?
Well, I think several things. It would have been seen as a political disaster for the president, particularly at the start, or what will formally be the start in January, of a new administration that the Congress, in fact, was able to stop something that the president said he was strongly behind. I think it would have equally been a trauma for intelligence reform because this bill had a tremendous emotional investment by the families of the 9/11 victims. That they had failed to be able to get any bill out of the House would have been seen, I think, itself as a failure. And I'm not sure if it wouldn't have really stopped intelligence reform in its tracks. Simply, it's too hard. This was a maximum effort, and yet it failed. So I think there was a lot riding on getting some sort of bill through this time.
Well, and David Kay, as you know, intelligence gathering was criticized post 9/11 because nobody connected the dots between these various Saudi Arabians taking flying lessons and then the chatter that later emerged about al-Qaeda planning an attack using airplanes. And then the intelligence community was criticized for connecting the dots too vigorously to make a case for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq that became the central reason for going to war. So is there a balance here somewhere about the information you get and what you do with it, how passively or aggressively you treat it?
No, I think both events really show that in the intelligence community there was a broken culture, of collection of information and a broken culture and mismanagement with regard to how you analyze the information you create. I think Senator McCain really nailed it correctly. This is a dysfunctional community. It really needs to be reformed. What I have some pause at this point when I listen to members of the 9/11 families, as you had on earlier, and they invest so much in this bill as if suddenly overnight the Intelligence Committee will be made whole and functional again. It took 40 years to get this bad. It's not going to be made whole by simply passing this bill. The real hard work still lies ahead.
And Jennifer Sims, do you see it as a broken culture? Do you see it in as dark terms as David Kay does?
Actually, I don't. I think that the intelligence community had some significant problems prior to 9/11, but I didn't think it was then dysfunctional, nor is it dysfunctional now. There are serious problems with the policies and practices within the intelligence community, and some of those surely can be corrected by structural change, but some of it just simply requires going back to first principles and better training, better tradecraft. For example, I think we have, in both the Iraq WMD case and in the 9/11 case, a failure of strategic analysis, the ability to put together the big picture. It's sort of like creating a jigsaw puzzle. One has to invest in people who make it their primary mission to assemble these pieces carefully, deliberately over many years, and I don't think we're as good at that as we have been in the past. There has been more recently a tendency to focus on current intelligence, the latest and breaking news, and I think that while that's very important, and certainly in the counterterrorism sense, we definitely want to have a strong capability in that area, we shouldn't do it at the expense of strategic analysis.
Well, and one of the terms that has gotten a lot of favor recently is stovepipes, you know, that all of these intelligence agencies are stovepipes that don't talk to each other, and so therefore they're not sharing information. Will having a national director of intelligence solve that problem?
Well, you know, I'm a bit of a contrarian on the whole issue of stovepipes. I think that stovepiping can be a problem in the collection business. But we actually, I think people, if they understood how the intelligence collection really works, they would find that the process of collecting intelligence, that is, the marrying up of sensors to the platforms that those sensors ride on to produce products that analysts use, is actually not really very much of a stovepipe in the way it actually functions. And what I'm concerned about, frankly, is when we create these centers based on missions, we are creating another kind of rigidity, not stovepipes so much, but new turf that people will want to protect. And we're moving into a world that is much more fluid, the threats are more fluid, and we need the ability to be flexible in our intelligence community and change missions as required to respond to those threats and opportunities. So I have some concern about restructuring around particular mission areas. That said, I think it's enormously important for us to focus on the counterterrorism mission post 9/11 to strengthen it and make it better. But we should not be building an intelligence community for 15 or 20 years out based solely on lessons learned from 9/11. We must remember that there are going to be other significant threats that arise, and we need to retain the flexibility in our intelligence community to respond to them.
Let's hear from one of our listeners now on the line from New York City. Eric, hi, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. First, I need to congratulate the families for the work they've done. And we all should all learn the lesson. If we're really committed, we can make change. And it's such an important lesson for us to learn. Here's my concern. This debate lacks clear thinking. And there's something that needs to be focused on. There's no substitute for actually setting priorities. If we're trying to fight Al-Qaeda, mere structural shifts are not going to do it. Look, right after September 11th, we funded Star Wars. Then we funded the Joint Strike Fighter. Then we took delivery of a $240 million fighter plane per fighter plane. We're still preparing to fight countries. In fact, we went ahead and fought a country instead of fighting Al-Qaeda. I'll believe that we're setting priorities rationally when I see that we're protecting the food supply, we're protecting our ports from nuclear weapons. Fundamentally, we keep saying that everything has changed since September 11th. I think that the people who know how to lobby, the entrenched interests that make fighter planes and all these kinds of things, know how to keep the priorities focused on war against country kind of technology.
Well, let me put that
thing that can be used against Al-Qaeda.
Thanks for the call, Eric, and let me put that question to David Kaye. Does that concern you as well?
Well, look, I think Eric's absolutely right. The key to good intelligence, key to a good national security policy is priorities and keeping to those priorities and assessing how well you're doing. There is some hope that a national intelligence director, in fact, will be able to set priorities for the intelligence community at least. Remember the hearing of the 9/11 Commission when it was reported that George Tenet had declared we were at war with Al-Qaeda. The head of the National Security Agency apparently never heard the declaration of war and went ahead with his own collection efforts, stovepiped as they were, quite independent of that overall determination. So, I mean, I think it's true in the intelligence area. It's true in national security policy in general. Priority setting is absolutely the key to success.
And, Gail, if I could just jump in there, in this debate involving Duncan Hunter over military intelligence, some folks in the intelligence community have described to me some real-world examples of how these priorities shake out. You have spy satellites. These are big, very expensive systems. There aren't very many of them. They orbit the Earth. They can only pass over a country but so many times in a given week and take pictures of so many things. you have a whole lot of entities in the government that want various pictures to be taken. Those needs can't all be met. Somebody has to decide. In the case of Iraq, you've had the military for really the past decade saying our top priority is finding out where the Iraqi air defenses are, because they're shooting down, they're threatening to shoot down our planes. We don't want to lose a pilot. So that became a very high priority mission for the imagery collectors at the expense of some of the imagery collection involving weapons of mass destruction. That's not to say that there was no imagery taken, to be sure, but at least some of the professionals in the business have described to me, again, how the emphasis can get tilted and some of the more strategic missions can go by the boards. And that's also happened in Iran. There's been so much focus on Iraq that there just hasn't been the capacity to do the thorough, frequent revisit coverage of some of these strategic targets in Iran as well. I'm sure David Kaye knows much more about this than I do, but at least that's what I've been hearing from folks in the community.
Well, John Diamond, I also want to ask you, if there is only going to be one national director of intelligence, does the bill specify who appoints that person? Is it Congress? Is it the president?
It's the president, and it's confirmed by the Senate, just like any major cabinet-level appointment.
And David Kaye, what's the downside and also what's the upside of having so much power and authority concentrated in one person?
Well, I think we have to be somewhat skeptical at this point as to whether, in fact, there will be a lot of power vested in that individual. There's a long history in Washington of czars being appointed and they end up being powerless figureheads. The drug czar, when did you last hear of it? The war on cancer and a cancer czar. So it really remains to be seen. You're dealing with 15 agencies and over $40 billion, very entrenched and very powerful bureaucracies. It remains to be seen who will be appointed, whether the president will truly back him up, whether, in fact, they're able to seize that leadership, and who are the troops that are going to provide them the analysis and the surround them with the budget authority and the ability to analyze those budgets to actually seize that authority and make it whole. I think this is a continuing, fascinating story in American government. It ranks right up there with Homeland Security and creating a Department of Homeland Security as to whether you can pull it off. And as John Diamond said earlier, the thing about intelligence, which is quite different even than Homeland Security, is these are agencies used to doing their work in secret, without public disclosure. In fact, the congressional oversight has been miserable with regard to these. I remain agnostic as to whether, in fact, the National Intelligence Director indeed will turn out to be powerful or will turn out just to be a figurehead who has trotted out to say, yes, we've done something serious.
To Fred now, who's on the line from Greensboro, North Carolina, and it sounds, Fred, as if you are wondering much the same thing.
You have answered my question quite a bit. Will this be a person who the general public is informed of? You know, will we have a face and a name to place on this director of national intelligence, someone who's holding so much power?
Yes, you will. This will be a high-profile appointed position who will come to Congress and testify from time to time. Right now we hear from the CIA director probably once or twice a year in a group of hearings known as the annual Worldwide Threat Brief. I suppose that the director of national intelligence may take up that duty. There will be public testimony on occasion, perhaps a majority of the appearances before Congress of this official will be behind closed doors, but the philosophy behind the bill is to create more of a free flow of information among the organizations that need to know it, whether it's in intelligence or law enforcement. And I think my reading of the bill is that this person is going to have a much more visible profile, perhaps, than other intelligence chiefs have had in the past.
Fred, thanks for the call. And Jennifer, let me ask you to expand on that point, because I'm wondering where this new director of intelligence should come from the political arena or the military or the intelligence community or somewhere else entirely.
Well, I think that choice is really up to the president, and he will have to put a very strong leader in as the first national intelligence director. That is because I agree with comments that everybody has made up to this point, that we are really at just the beginning of the reform process. This bill marks the first step, really. We now need to put in place the policies, regulations, and practices that will allow this whole system to function. And doing that will require sorting out some very sticky issues. For example, one issue we haven't talked about yet is the chain of command for chiefs of station overseas. And as we all know, chiefs of station are responsible for human espionage overseas. But they have also been responsible for the coordination of all intelligence activities, not just the CIA's, but the National Security Agency that does signals intelligence collection when it operates overseas. These other agencies all must be coordinated by chiefs of station. And they have always reported to one person, the Director of Central Intelligence. With now a chief of Central Intelligence who will be responsible for human espionage, and another position, the Director of National Intelligence, who will be responsible for community-wide activities, the chief of station is going to have some guidance on how he reports and when he reports to this new management layer in Washington. These kinds of sorting out of reporting chains are going to be very tricky.
And that's a story right out of the headlines, because we saw the piece in the front page of the New York Times today about the station chief in Baghdad. His report became public about his concerns about absolute chaos there.
Exactly. Chiefs of station are very important because they have tremendous management responsibilities and work with ambassadors to sort out operations overseas. But they also are very important to human intelligence collectors with their own views, analytic views, if you will, on the evolving events overseas. And directors of Central Intelligence have always taken both roles very seriously. And chiefs of station really have never had any question about to whom they report and to whom they are responsible. I see this as one of the biggest challenges we face, and frankly, one that is coming at an awfully awkward time. We are at war. We are very engaged in Iraq, but we also have the global war on terror to prosecute. And I join others in commending the families who have drawn all of our attention to the need for improved counterterrorism capabilities. But I know the families, too, want these issues sorted out so that we can prosecute the war on terror. As the president has said, we must take this fight overseas. And in the front lines are the chiefs of station.
All right. Jennifer Sims, David Kay, and John Diamond, stay with us if you will. We have to take a quick break, and then we're going to continue our discussion of the intelligence reform bill. After weeks of Capitol Hill infighting, it did reach a vote tonight in the House, and it passed overwhelmingly. So does it make sense to have an intelligence uber director, or are civil liberties compromised when one person has so much power? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harris, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about a massive overhaul of U.S. intelligence gathering efforts. A hotly contested bill was voted on this evening in the House of Representatives. It passed overwhelmingly. But what's in it, and will it help prevent another 9/11? Does it make sense to have one intelligence director? And if so, whom would you like to see take the job? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with John Diamond, Washington correspondent for USA Today, with Jennifer Sims, visiting professor of intelligence at Georgetown Security Studies Program, and David Kay, former chief U.S. arms inspector in Iraq. And Wally's on the line now from Weston, Massachusetts. Hi, Wally. What do you think of all this?
Well, I have a question about leadership style. And all through the buildup to Iraq, we heard about, I read about articles that said that policy was driving intelligence instead of intelligence driving policy. And I wonder, the whole question of command climate, the climate of command in Abu Ghraib, and the issue of whether the president has an agenda beforehand that will influence the intelligence that's given to him, or does he have an open mind and says, tell me what's going on, and we'll react to it and figure out what to do next. I wish the 9/11 Commission had had some words about management style and what management needs to do in order to make better use of the intelligence they get. I think the whole intelligence buildup before 9/11 and Iraq was the intelligence was being used to further the agenda of the people that wanted to do what they wanted to do, and that can happen even with a czar.
Well, thank you for the call, Wally, and that sounds like a question that should go first to David Kay.
Well, I think in general, I think all of us would say you're better off with a management climate that searches out for information to inform the policy that it wants to take. I don't think intelligence drives policy. I think intelligence and experience and a lot of other things ought to inform policy, but ultimately we elect leaders to make wise judgments, or at least we hope wise judgments, about the policy of the nation. And intelligence is never infallible. I will say, and we've got another commission, as John Diamond earlier reported, that will report in about 3 months, a little less than 3 months now, headed by former Senator Robb, on the WMD issue. But on the WMD issue, I think what's going to be revealed, and the Senate Intelligence Committee has already given its report, is that, quite frankly, the intelligence was simply so badly done and so wrong that even policymakers who would like to have been informed, who had an open mind, simply would have been led to the wrong conclusions by the intelligence. That's why this is such a hard issue. You can't point fingers and say, well, there were closed minds at the top and it didn't really matter, when in fact the intelligence was pointing that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And you've got to sort out a whole series of issues. I don't think there's been a short of the day we're commemorating today, I guess, Pearl Harbor Day, at which we've been at more of a crossroads with so many of our institutions responsible for national security policy in question.
Well, it certainly does seem inevitable that bad intelligence would drive bad decisions. I was struck by a quote I read today from a longtime CIA hand who said that having a national intelligence director was like the Wizard of Oz, that this was someone who might appear to be running things, but who actually had very little involvement in the real substance. Jennifer?
I know that's an opinion. I recently had a head of a foreign intelligence, just stepped down, head of a foreign intelligence agency. So you say to me that, well, if you go ahead with this creation, I can assure you that when I come or my successor comes to the U.S., we'll make a courtesy call on this individual, but then we'll go see the people, the real people in the Central Intelligence Agency and the Defense Intelligence Agency, who are, in fact, collecting and analyzing intelligence. The real challenge of this leader is going to be to show that he is really doing real work and not just a public exercise of public relations.
Jennifer, any concerns about a Wizard of Oz there?
Well, actually, I do think that this is a problem, and I hope I'm not mischaracterizing his views, but I think the former director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, has talked about how hard it is to operate in senior levels of the policymaking apparatus in Washington without having the backing of a line agency underneath you. It really is an advantage to have the day-in, day-out management connection with the people who are doing the business. So I do think there is some concern about that, and this is why I talked about how important it will be for this person to be have strong backing from the president and to be somebody who can discern what are the important roles for him to take on, if it is a he. Could be a she, I suppose. But I also think that there is a particular role that is missing right now, and it goes back to your caller's point. I do think we could make progress in educating the users of intelligence about how the process works and what intelligence can do and can't do.
John?
I was going to throw in, Gail, that it's interesting. The 9/11 problem and the Iraq WMD problem raise different issues in terms of weaknesses in intelligence, and in some sense, there's potentially a conflict. Congressman David Obey, one of the few Democrats to vote against the bill, made this point today. The view on 9/11 was that there needs to be this powerful figure who can get information moving across the many organizations of the intelligence community, so you create this single powerful figurehead. In the case of Iraq, the complaint has arisen that the president, the administration, was not seeing enough conflicting or contrasting opinions on the intelligence. There was just sort of one view. I don't think that's actually true. I think there were conflicting opinions, and they were reaching the president. But this has been a complaint, and there's a concern that this one intelligence czar, if you will present a single opinion and may stifle the presentation to the administration of multiple points of view.
Well, and also, what about the accountability problem? Because there's been a suggestion that since the new director would not be directly in charge of the CIA's clandestine operations, for example, he wouldn't be accountable when some of them went wrong, as some of them inevitably do.
Yes, well, I think that when they do go wrong, when there are problems, that's almost always entirely kept secret. It's the rare covert operation that comes into public view. It has to be a pretty flaming disaster for it to come out into the open. There is a fairly fixed and well-established system of congressional oversight for approval of covert operations up to the level of the president, and that oversight by Congress. There's no change in how that's going to work as far as I can see it. And the CIA, the Directorate of Operations, the CIA director, the administration as a whole will still be responsible.
David Kaye and Jennifer, I'd like to each ask you to reflect on, if not a specific person, actually I'd prefer hearing a specific name, but if not a specific person, who should take this job?
David? I'll let David answer that.
Thank you, Jennifer. No, I'll speak about the characteristics. I think, and John Diamond referred to something I think is key earlier, this individual is going to have a much more open public role than the former, whoever was director of Central Intelligence in the past. I think it's terribly important that he be seen as an individual who is not afraid of speaking truth to power, that has, in fact, obviously will have the competence of the president or would not have been given the job, is not part of the inner political elite of the president. It's also going to require someone that is, quite frankly, not afraid to break some crockery. Because unless you break some crockery, challenge some past norms, you're going to very easily fall into the trap of most czars in the U.S. government. You'll be symbolically powerful, but not powerful in reality.
Well, we'll have to leave it there for now. So, Jennifer, you'll be relieved to hear you're off the hook on that point. Jennifer Sims, David Kaye, John Diamond, thank you all for joining us.
Thank you, Gail.
Good to be here.
You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, one mother worries about the political dialogue to which the next generation is being exposed. I'm Gail Harris, and this is On Point. Even as his approval ratings have headed north since the election, President Bush remains a target of scorn throughout large sections of the country. One website being forwarded through emails features a game whose object is to drop brains inside the president's hollow head. At the same time, Bill Clinton remains a favorite whipping boy on right-wing talk shows and websites, despite having been out of office for 4 years. California writer Kathleen Clary Miller remembers a time when political leaders were afforded a little more respect in the national dialogue. In this radio diary, she wonders how the next generation will grow up viewing their elected officials.
I was seated in the waiting room at the doctor's office when I observed a mother reading to her very young son and daughter. I couldn't see the cover of the publication, nor did I recognize the page design, as anything I had ever perused during the often endless delay in medical settings. It was a book clearly written for the benefit of young children. There were large pictures, the language was simple, the sentences were short. But even the brightest adult might be confused by the subject matter. Our presidents. I couldn't help but notice the content I began to hear from across the room. Richard Nixon committed the crime of stealing and lying about it when he told certain people who worked for him in the government that it was okay to listen to the plans of the opposite side during the election. He decided to stop being president rather than let the American people force him to leave. The mother paused to let this information sink in, then resumed. Gerald Ford, the vice president, took his place and was most known for falling down a lot. They giggled. But then their eyes widened and their faces grew more somber as their mother continued. Bill Clinton committed inappropriate sexual acts with a young woman who worked for him, even though he was married. And so as I found myself staring at the children, I couldn't help but feel sorry that they had to hear such things about the leaders of their country. I hadn't had to fall privy to intimate knowledge about the officials I admired until I was much older. I realize the fact that history is taught realistically now is necessary and proper. But at what age shall absolute truth cease to traumatize and begin to set you free? These very young children looked horrified as the little girl asked her mother about Clinton. Why did he do that? The woman looked up to the ceiling, pondering her answer. When I was a bit older than these children, perched at their mother's side, listening to read aloud stories, President Kennedy was assassinated. At my age, he was our leader, whom we admired and esteemed, the President of the United States, like Abraham Lincoln. We were too young to question his deserving our adoration. In our elected officials, we held high hope. We remained oblivious to the so-called indiscretions, the Marilyn Monroes, the possible links to mafia, and other corruption that as adults we now read about every day. What would I have done with that information at an age too inexperienced to yet reconcile my own failings? It was when I grew older that I began to hear the truth about all sorts of people, when at least I could more easily process the fact that no one is perfect. Had I known the truth too early, I fear I would have felt far from set free. Rather, I might have become imprisoned within walls of distrust and disillusionment toward those who govern. Lord knows it's difficult enough not to feel the futility of it all as a middle-aged adult. So as my name was called to follow the nurse back to the examining room, I glanced back over my shoulder to see brother and sister looking serious, sad, bogged down by this tale full of unhappy endings. Would these two be inspired to vote when they turned 18? Would they ever become immersed in the thrill and heady excitement of working long hours on a favorite candidate's campaign based on what they now already knew? As I waited for the doctor to come in, I hoped to myself that what they would determine was that if moral and ethical behavior is missing from the White House and the history books that portray the office of the presidency, it is they who will need to and can bring it back.
Kathleen Miller is a writer living in San Juan Capistrano, California. She recently completed her first novel, The Man in My Mailbox. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.